Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP's secret location in the Great White North and FYP West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 107 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday, Larry. How are you?
Well, doing great, Andy. And it's Christmas Eve, Eve, Eve.
It's Christmas Eve, Eve. Wait, it's not Saturday night, is it?
It's Sunday, so it's we've got Eve is be Tuesday, Eve would be Monday, so it's Eve. Like I said, today's Sunday.
Okay, well, I said it was Saturday. I was confused. I'm all discombobulated again. So, how are you this evening?
I'm just looking forward to having this great episode of Registry Matters that I'm going to be on my Christmas holidays.
Fantastic. We actually weren't going to record. We had planned on taking the day off, the week off, whatever. And then you came up with this, the late breaking news of the evening of this Doe versus Abbott. So we threw together, maybe it'll run an hour, maybe just a little bit over, but that's the plan. So what's up with this, Doe v. Abbott?
Well, we're going to do a deeper dive in it, but this is a case out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the United States Circuit Court for the Fifth Circuit, which includes Texas and Louisiana, and in that South Central corridor there. And the challenge was against the registry in Texas. So this attorney named Linda Estes Hightower had filed a complaint in 2018, quite a lengthy complaint, and there was a lot of criticism of Ms. Hightower. And I had spoken less critical of Ms. Hightower, but with some dubiosity. So now after the district court extinguished her case, she filed an appeal of the district court's dismissal for failure to state a claim for which relief could be granted, and she lost. So the Fifth Circuit has said that Texas registry has not evolved to the point where it's punitive. So you guys in Texas, you're going to have to wait till things get worse or until you get a different set of judges on the courts of appeals, on the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit and at the district court level in Texas.
Right. I understand. Is she the, I think she was on a Narsalan action and maybe not, but I remember hearing people complaining that there was an attorney in Texas that was like soliciting work. Is this the same woman that was doing that?
This is in fact the attorney who had solicited people in Texas and in Florida. And as far as I know, she still has an active case in Florida. Hopefully it doesn't meet the same end result. But at the time, we've never had her on an Arsenal action call, but okay. I thought about it. But I got a lot of pushback from Texans because they said that she was, very unflattering comments were made about her. And I didn't agree with those unflattering comments. First of all, they're unprofessional to make, and you shouldn't do that. If you have a problem with an attorney in terms of their professionalism, there's a process to make those complaints. But I didn't see anything unethical about her soliciting clients. The rules have long since been changed about that, and I didn't see anything unethical with her asking for payment for the services. As she pointed out, she's got staff, office, overhead, people expecting to be paid, and she reminded me that she didn't put these people on the registry.
Why would any, I mean, is her doing that any different? And I'm not trying to make this direct comparison, but you see, you know, ambulance chaser kind of attorneys, they're not soliciting you directly, but they're saying, hey, have you been hurt in an accident? Is this any different than that?
Well, they actually do solicit you directly. The attorneys do get reports of accidents. They do DWI arrest histories. They're checking the jail police blotter, and they actually do solicit people that have been in situations where they might need a lawyer. And the rules of professional conduct permit that as long as you disclose that it's a lawyer advertisement. I don't see anything particularly unethical. And it wouldn't matter if I did, because the people who make the rules have said that advertising for clients is not unethical. So you may disagree with it, but they're allowed to do it. They're allowed to do it like every other business.
Yeah, I'm trying to see why it would be different for me to walk in there and hand up my card and say, I do computer work. Are you interested in having business, setting up a relationship? How would that be different than an attorney doing something vaguely similar?
Well, it goes back to people who have the power tend to want to retain the power. Years ago, lawyers who had become very well known and had established firms, larger firms, they wanted to have barriers to entry. And you'll find that if you're trying to get a taxi medallion which are becoming less valuable in the day of Uber. But if you're trying
Right.
to if you're trying to get a tow truck operator's license, or all these people who have their interest to protect, whether they be counselors, whether they be dental assistants or dental hygienists, magically you need a license. Magically you need all this, and magically you have these rules that these governing boards impose. And one that had lasted for generations was that lawyers, it was somehow unseemly of the profession to advertise, and they weren't allowed to do. If you go back 30 years, most of the lawyer advertisements would be in telephone yellow pages. That'd be where you'd find an attorney. Well, guess
of
who
course.
Could afford to be in the yellow pages? It wouldn't be your up-and-coming lawyer who just got out of law school with thousands of dollars of debt, and they're in a little a tiny shanty somewhere trying to make a go of it. It would be the lawyers who had multiple lawyers in their firm, and they would have the resources to shell out the kind of money that the telephone company, as the telephone company was a monopoly until the early 80s, that they would have required for those full page, half page, and quarter page ads.
So there's nothing at all oogie about an attorney soliciting that way?
I think, of course, you could go to the point where it would be. I mean, if you showed up at the funeral parlor, I mean, it might be.
All right.
I mean, you take it anything to an extreme, but people who have been injured and people who have suffered whatever the situation is, often they're not the clearest of thinkers, and they are in need of help. And I guess it would be like when Colonel Tom Parker showed up after Elvis died. That was his long-term manager. When he handed the agreement to Vernon, Elvis's father, and said, "I'd like to continue to manage Elvis's business," and Elvis had given him 50% of everything, and Vernon found out later that was not an ethical arrangement, that no one gets 50%. So he moved to set aside the agreement because it was done in a time of duress. There is a point to where you can take something too far.
Yeah, Charles, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase it. Could you make the argument that a person that is soliciting the business, not necessarily, but possibly has a better level of experience in the field since they're soliciting for it than you going on knocking on various attorneys' door going, "Do you have experience in this?" And they'd be like, "Yeah, sure, I got all kinds of experience." And they don't know a freaking thing about dealing with the registry at all.
I think that's a good comparison because that's exactly what Charles is up against as he does his shopping. He's going to encounter a lot of attorneys who have filed for a downgrade in the person's level, but he's probably not going to find, he's going to spend a lot of time trying to find an attorney who's filed a challenge saying that the person's offense was not close enough to a New York offense that it didn't require registration. There's going to be far fewer of those attorneys, but someone who's going to be hungry and has a mortgage payment to make and who has a payroll to make, they're going to say, "Well, sure, well, I can do that. I guess I've taken many of these issues up on levels of registration, and this is just an offshoot of that," is what they're going to tell him. And he's going to believe it because the lawyer has a nice suit. It's kind of like the Baptist minister. The lawyer has the nice suit, the nice office, and it sounds really good. And you want to believe in the person.
Of course. All right. Well, then we will cover that before we close out the show.
Let me back off on the Baptist ministers because we're going to get hate mail for that. But if you've ever been to a Southern Baptist church, you will have to agree that there's something about the way those preachers dress. They really go all out.
Is that before or after they handle the snakes? Just kidding.
I'm not talking about those primitive. I'm talking about a regular Southern Baptist SBC church. As I grew up in the South, you go in those churches, and if you watch the movie Oh God, you'll see how that they portrayed him exactly like I remember Baptist preachers dressed up with the jewelry and everything.
And then you have an update that there was something with Galen Bochman, whatever that is, appellate review for his probation revocation.
I did, and I think we can spend some time on it, and it would be helpful for people. It's not gonna be something where it's gonna apply the way that people had expected. Galen had two issues. He had his probation revoked for communicating with a minor who was over 16, and the communication was not criminal, but it was a violation of his terms of sex offender supervision, and he ended up having his probation revoked, and they imposed a year, and then they remitted him to probation after the year, with it converted to lifetime with some additional requirements, including no internet access. And And so when the year almost expired, the state of Virginia filed a petition to commit him civilly, which is where NARSL has great interest because it's the second civil commitment petition. And he did not commit another sex offense. But this was merely on the criminal action on the side of his revocation. Was there grounds to revoke his supervision and to put him on lifetime supervision, which was not what he originally had? And could they prohibit him from being on the internet? And the answer was yes to all of his three appellate issues, that they could do all three of those things.
But I thought we resolved that with PackyCan, that they can't make a blanket internet ban.
Well, they can't make a blanket internet ban for a whole group of people. But one thing I've tried to stress on this podcast is that what can be done to an individual with uniquely tailored circumstances that's targeted for that particular offender, not just because you feel good or you hate the class of offenders, you can do most anything. They put this restriction, it was narrowly tailored and targeted to him. He had problems with not using the internet properly that got him in trouble the first time. And then while under supervision, which sex offender supervision is pretty stringent in most instances, may not be in the Peach State. It sounds like in Peach State, it's a panacea of fun. from what I hear, people travel all over the country and they do what they want to do. But in this case, he was under fairly stringent supervision, although they were giving him some liberal travel. So he traveled to Minnesota to a funeral, and then he took up a liking to a 16-year-old boy, and they started texting and tried to tell him how to avoid the collection of being able to provide. He was telling them ways to evade detection. He was saying Snapchat and some of these other platforms would not be trackable. And the parents found out about it, and they just didn't think it was such a great idea for a person 40 years old to be texting their 16-year-old telling them how to avoid parental oversight. so they contacted the authorities in Virginia, and they revoked him for this. So this is a narrowly tailored ban. And at the time they revoked his probation, Packingham had not been released. So the appellate court, this is from the Court of Appeals in Virginia. And I think there's one more level that they can go to if they are determined they could file a cert petition with the state's highest court. But the appellate court said that the trial judge had every reason to do what he did because of the unique circumstances of Galen. That all other attempts to oversee him had been unsuccessful. And then what I really think is I hate to use the word funny because you chewed me out about doing that, but they brought in Dr. Fred Berlin. You know, you've all heard of Fred Berlin, right? He's the guru of sex offender treatment.
A kabuki doctor.
Well, no, he's supposedly well respected, and Narsil's just—I think he might even be on the agenda for the conference. I think he's going to be a speaker, but he's treated some high-profile cases, and he's got national recognition. Well, Dr. Berlin—they decided to call him as their expert. Well, Berlin admitted this is always funny when your own witness screws you. Berlin said that he didn't believe that Galen was grooming. But he said it certainly could be it could be perceived that way. He says, Dr. Berlin testified, I've got this highlighted on page 4, grooming is a three-step process. Step 1, referred to establishment of a relationship of trust with a minor. Step 2, referred to gauging the minor's interest in sexual relationship. And step 3, referred to additional efforts by the groomer to turn his or her relationship with the minor to a sexualized relationship. Dr. Berlin ultimately testified that his expert opinion, appellant, who's Galen, had no intention of turning the relationship sexual, but he said that it could certainly be perceived that way. Well, that's kind of bad when you say, well, it would be reasonable to you. He said the appellant's conduct could have been interpreted to have constituted step 1. That's just not real good for your expert that you probably paid good money to come in and say that.
Yeah. Well, all right. So they can make some kind of blanket internet or other various tailorings, depending on what you are known to be, have a proclivity towards.
Well, that's what this level of appellate review has yielded. But they also said that he could go back and view a Packingham and he could file for reconsideration of that extreme restriction and ask the court to consider Packingham, and they might relax that. But right now he's in civil commitment, which is where we have a great interest, because he shouldn't have had to go through a second civil commitment process, being that he'd already beat the first one years ago and they didn't have a new sex offense. They had behavior that at best could be categorized as grooming, which, as Galen pointed out in his case on appeal here, that it was not against the law to have conversations with a 16-year-old. There's nothing unlawful about that. It was a violation of probation. So therefore, the Commonwealth committed him to an institution based on something he might do, not on something he's done, but something he might do.
But I mean, not based on any sort of, it's similar to the Cosby thing where they brought in the ladies to give a sort of an MO. Here's the MO of something that paints a picture of what has been done in the past. Possibly you could use that to project forward of what could be done in the future.
That's what they did. But we don't, in the United States, we don't detain people for what they might do. We detain them for what they have done. And talking to a minor doesn't rise to the level. If he actually were to have a sexual liaison in Minnesota, it would have been legal because the age of consent was 16, is 16. But in the Commonwealth of Virginia, it wouldn't have been. So he would have had to have been sophisticated enough to know which state to have the relationship in. Now, I'm not advising anybody to break the law, but but certainly you need to be aware of what the age of consent is in whatever situation you find yourself, because it varies from state to state. So you could find something very hot in one state that you would be completely lawful in doing it. And then if you go just across the border to the next state, the same scenario arises and it would put you in prison for a long period of time.
I understand. Let's move over to courthouse news. And Larry, this is just like, you know, funny, haha, not funny, really. Ex-cop gets 10 years for forcing teens to run naked. He pulled these two 18-year-olds, so young women, over for running a stop sign. And after he found a small amount of alcohol and the wacky weed stuff, he laid down an ultimatum: take your clothes off and run around or go to jail. I don't see a problem with this.
Well, I actually do. I'm against harsh sentencing. Now, there's a lot of people out there that are salivating, that are listening. They're saying, well, the cop finally got his, what do you call it, comeuppance?
But the comeuppance, yes.
But that's hypocrisy at its finest. If we believe in fair sentencing and for the sentence to fit the crime, for the punishment to fit the crime, I think 10 years is just a tad bit on the excessive side. Now, Florida is known for being harsh. It's one of those southern states where they believe that harsh sentencing is the answer to all problems. But 10 years, I didn't catch anywhere in there where there was actually any sexual activity that took place. No. This was at most very embarrassing to them.
He also asked one of the teenagers for a hand job. Forgive me for being some level of graphic.
Well, again, that would still not rise to the level of sexual assault on either of the teenagers. Don't think 10 years in prison for requesting whatever you called it. I don't think that. This is a family program, you know.
Of course. How about like the idea that the jury came back with a guilty verdict on counts of extortion? I think you could say extortion is almost like a quid pro quo, and unlawful compensation.
Well, clearly he broke the law.
Yes, but he clearly broke the law. So a 10-year sentence and ruled that the former officer can be released from custody on a $20,000 bond pending appeal.
Yeah, and that's a perk that very few people get these days, is an appeal bond. But
so he gets to avoid prison while he's doing the appeal?
Well, and I don't know how often that's granted in Florida. As times have gotten tougher with criminal procedure, the appellate bonds have gotten more and more scarce, because people, after they've been convicted, the argument is they're evading punishment. So you really have hoops to jump through to get an appeal bond, and they set a pretty high one. And they usually have you have to have some substantial significant issue to appeal. Just because you don't like the verdict, that's not enough in many circumstances for you to be granted an appeal bond. So you've got to convince your trial judge that you've got some significant issues on appeal. And so he's lucky in that regard. But again, 10 years, assuming in Florida you serve the overwhelming majority, and I think you do. I don't think they have even parole in Florida. I think you serve your sentence less whatever little good time they give you. But that's a lot of time for this behavior. I would say, like so, I said about the teacher in Connecticut that had the romantic relationship with the student. Clearly, right. This guy should not be on the police department. This power went to his head that he had this type of power. So clearly, he shouldn't be a police officer ever again. So his certification to be a cop should be revoked. He should be punished in some fashion. Punishment doesn't always have to be behind the prison walls. How can we claim that we're for reform and reducing our prison industrial complex if we think the answer to everything is to send a person to prison? I'm suspecting that he had no criminal behavior ever before, or he wouldn't have been on the police force to start with. So why is it that we demand such harsh treatment for a person? Yes, he broke the trust of the people. And yes, there has to be some kind of accountability, but I don't think the 10 years is the right sentence for him.
So two final things. Charles in chat says that the British slang would be a hand shandy. So now you're educated on British slang. And then also his wife is not happy.
A what? A hand?
Hand shandy? I don't know. I don't know some British slang stuff. Charles is crazy. That's all I know.
A hand shandy. All right.
Yeah, there you go. Over at JS Online, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Attorneys sue to block vote on Marcy's Law that would expand crime victims' rights. Here we go again with Marcy's Law. And I know you're going to say that this will pass with flying colors without any sort of resistance.
It will.
And Marcy's Law, why do people... So Marcy's Law is something that gives the victim some sort of, like, I mean, skin in the game. They get to attend hearings. They get to, like, have input into whether you get released on parole, probation, whatever you have. And how do the victims and the victims' advocates gain any sort of standing in this process?
Well, that's where you and I may not have the same belief. I believe a victim is nothing more than a witness.
I disagree with you.
The crime is against the people. And
yeah,
and,
it always says the state versus the person. You know, it says Doe versus the state of Oklahoma.
Right. Well, and that's what I tell people, and they roll their eyes and they start hissing and making all kinds. But as an organized society, we have come together, and we have collectively decided what our rules are for behavior. So that means the people have decided that certain behavior is not acceptable, and the people have put together a process that holds those accountable for violating those standards of behavior. And it's the orderly process that prevents vigilantism. The fact that a person who's been victimized is a witness, when they come forward and participate in the people's process, there's an expectation that the people's process take into account their needs. But that doesn't make them a player in the process. They're merely a witness, according to what I believe. That the more you involve them in the decision making, the more you inject bias into a system that's supposed to be free of that prejudice. Supposedly the 12 jurors are totally independent. The judge is totally independent. And they're not supposed to be. If you ask the person who's been victimized, when you come home and your place is completely ransacked and your whole lifetime of possessions have been stomped on and destroyed, you're very emotional, and some of those things could not be replaced, even though it's just property crime. You're not going to be particularly rational. If you find that person, you're not going to sit down and say, now, can you tell me a little bit about what caused you to do this? The average person's not going to react that way. So I don't believe that the victims should have the level of say-so that they have. They are witnesses in a process that was designed by the people to keep fairness and keep irrationality at bay. You can't be irrational. I mean, you can't be rational. You absolutely can be irrational if you've been a victim of a crime. And most people, including me, would be. I was. I got attacked physically one time, and I was very rational about what should happen to the person, because you just can't think about rationally why a person would do that.
So I, what you're describing is something to do with, like, you have constitutionally protected rights of being the accused person. And it does say in the article that this amendment would interfere with the constitutional rights of the accused. But supporters say it levels the playing field, but it really does just the opposite. It stacks the deck against the accused. I think that it gives much more power to already the a pretty powerful entity of the district attorney and the prosecutors.
Well, when you start injecting constitutional rights for victims, you have the potential for real problems. But this is going to pass. The Wisconsin voters are going to, and any state voters would, because it sounds good. And if you fall into the belief that the system is so bad that everybody gets away with practically everything, this just sounds simple and easy, and this is to level the playing field. So it would be surprised me if it didn't pass by 70%+ of the vote, maybe even 80.
And I assume this train is already rolling. The only thing that we could do collectively for the people in Wisconsin would be to call your local dude or chick and say,
too late. It's already going to the people. This is a referendum being voted on by the people.
That's why they're describing it as the the people aren't being educated well enough on it. I'm trying to see where it says that. Okay.
It's already gone through to go to the people. I think it has to go through two legislative sessions. That's done that. So now it's going out to the people, and the people are going to ratify it overwhelmingly. It'd be 70-80%.
Yeah. Just because the lawsuit argues the ballot question does not adequately summarize the effects of the measure. And so, yeah, the state constitution requires each amendment. So this is a constitutional amendment even.
Yes. That's what makes it so dangerous.
Yeah. But then doesn't that set something up to be thrown at the Supreme Court also?
Well, it would only be if you could come up with some constitutional violation. It's not against the law to change your constitution. That's why we have the amendment process.
I get that part of it. I'm just wondering, does it then challenge anything at the federal constitution that would bring up that level to get up to SCOTUS?
Well, possibly if it extinguishes U.S. constitutional rights, if this amendment does that, yes. But it'll take years to get there, and a whole lot of people will suffer.
Of course, of course. Interesting.
So.
You people I'm inclined to believe that the current makeup of this of SCOTUS would be more inclined to weigh against a Marcy's Law kind of provision.
You actually think that this Supreme Court is concerned about the rights of the accused? Really?
No, but I don't. But based on at least like a Gorsuch kind of ideology, man, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that victims have any rights. So this would extend beyond that. Potentially screwing up an accused person. Not that they're weighing in favor of the accused, but they're like, hey, you don't have any rights. There was nothing framed 200 years ago that said that the victims have rights.
But that's not so the analysis that would take place. The analysis would take place would be, does this violate any rights? You can create rights all day long, and you can give people things that are not in the Constitution. The question is, does the Constitution prohibit this? And I think absolutely the Constitution may not prohibit this. I think, depending on what, and I'm talking out without knowing what gifts are being given to the victims and what rights of the accused are being extinguished. But unless we're extinguishing rights of the accused, there's nothing the Supreme Court can do about it. The people of Wisconsin have the right to change the process by how they administer justice.
Yeah.
It's not Gorsuch's business, and Gorsuch is not going to care much about what happens to the accused. I mean, if you think this crowd cares about the rights of the accused, then you would look at over the last 15 years of how they've been extinguishing the rights of the accused.
I'm not looking at it from the rights of the accused. I'm looking at it of the accuser, the victim, having more rights, being given more rights than what they were. That's the only angle that I was looking at it from.
Yeah, but you've forgotten some of the Scalia clips we played. Scalia has said, if you want to do something, go pass a law, and that's correct. What the people are doing. They're creating a process, and unless this process is prohibited by some constitution, they have every right to change their process. I just don't agree with it. I am solidly for the defense in our adversarial system. I do not spend any time trying to help the victims. I think they're well represented by all the apparatuses that take care of them. And I'm in the business solely of trying to prevent as many people as I can from being harmed by a bureaucracy that has many times, I can't even begin to tell you the arithmetic formula of how many times in excess of your resources that system has. So certainly, it's a David versus Goliath thing. And every time we make it easier for convictions, we're going to have more convictions. So,
of course,
and every time we make it more difficult for a person who's been convicted to have any type of remediation, when you have to have everything. I mean, we've got states now where petitions for removal from the registry, which is supposed to be a civil regulatory scheme, where they have to notify the victims. Really? Really? They have to notify the victims. Okay, so they've already paid their debt to society. So you should be completely out of the equation right now. But they have to notify the victim to see what they think about them being removed from the registry.
Right. It's, I mean, from that angle, then, this is no different than a state making capital punishment legal.
Correct.
Or illegal. And the
Correct.
Same as, yeah, okay. And yeah, since it doesn't violate a core principle such as a Second Amendment, they're free to do it as they want to.
That's correct. The Constitution doesn't require you to capitally punish people, but according to the conservatives, it's not against the Constitution. If you take that view that they took, that cruel and unusual punishment would be what it meant at the time the framers wrote those words, none of this mumbo jumbo about evolving standards of decency and about how society evolves and thinks about things in a different light after it gains more knowledge and more experience about how the death penalty has been unfairly administered. And how it has I mean, it's really been quite a travesty in how the death penalty has been administered across this country. But they take the view that, well, nothing mandates you doing capital punishment. If you're opposed to it, go pass the law. I played that Scalia clip more than once, I think, on this podcast, because people think that somehow or another that Scalia is going to save them from this stuff. Of course, he's not, because he's deceased. But people of that mindset who believe that that you should interpret the Constitution exactly by what the words would have meant at that time, you wouldn't like most of what you get in the way of interpretation. I hate to tell you that.
Yeah, I still don't really see how that actually can be the mindset, to be honest with you. I just don't see how that actually works.
Well, it works occasionally, and when it works occasionally, I like to use things that work occasionally. But it's kind of like the textualism, which is also another core belief of Scalia. Textualism works occasionally, and when it does, I'm all for it.
And the attorney that we had the guest on, Andrew Torres, I've heard him describe the whole idea. But there's case law after case law after case law. The standard constantly moves the needle. We are always revisiting cases. New things are brought up, and that becomes the new standard. It just by its design, it evolves.
Not according to Scalia, it does not.
But like, you have all of the case law that says, like, forget what he says. It's like, you can tell me your. I mean, you can tell me that you're 11 feet taller, but I can just look at you and tell you that you are not. But you can believe it all you want. You could believe that it doesn't evolve, but you could just watch the body of case law, and it does move. There is a changing of perception, and each of the states have a different perception of things. We have 50, you know, there are variations across the states.
Well, my point is, if you fill the court with Scalia's, that's what you would get, would be that mentality that he displayed. And he adhered to that almost. I mean, I think on one thing where I pointed out once or twice where I said it'd be nice if he was actually intellectually honest here, but he adhered to that ideology most of the time. And right. That's what guided him and how he interpreted the law. And
certainly,
you wouldn't like that. I mean, we went through a whole series of appellate and state Supreme Court decisions, you know, from Nebraska to Maryland to the porn possession in Maryland, where there was no exception in the statute. And I pointed out that was actually a textual interpretation. The lawmakers didn't create an exception. So the Maryland Supreme Court said, well, we're not going to create something by judicial fiat. I mean, that's not our job. So
that
so
was the
if you're
the girl that had the porn of herself, I guess it was. If
yes,
I remember right.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But we've gone through a series of those. And I was hoping to let people know, if you think you're a textualist, you just may not be what you think you are when you find out what the resulting decisions are if you take merely a textualist view without any reliance on what the intent of the law is. And that's what you get. So if you don't like it, go back and change the law.
Moving over to the Boston Globe, scores of sex offenders have state licenses bum, 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 to be electricians, manicurists, and more, Larry. The official who found out got fired. That part's the weird part of this story, so sort of like a whistleblower person got fired. But you have all kinds of registered sex offenders. They are doing these various trade jobs where they need licenses, and the licensing administrations, they are not doing background checks, and they're letting these 68 people have these state-held licenses, including electricians, 21 electricians. I don't know what 8, including Bros of Leominster. I don't even know what that means. I guess that's the individual. It was a level 3. We shouldn't have level 3 offenders being electricians, I don't believe.
Can't have that.
Why? Other than some... Okay, should we allow... Let's see. If we were to believe the rating system to not be kabuki stuff, and you have determined someone to be a high-level threat, would you want them to be unsupervised and enter into potentially a person that could be violated by this person entering the house? Would you want to just let them go willy-nilly and run around the city unsupervised?
Well, again, I would go back to, have they paid their debt to society in its totality? The registry, remember, is a civil regulatory scheme. So while a person's being punished, so if they're serving any portion of their sentence, be it in the community, then I would say that the community has the prerogative to intrude into their life a little bit. If these people have paid their debts to society and they're merely having to register in the civil regulatory scheme, absolutely they should be able to hold any license and do any job if they meet the criteria for that profession. Why wouldn't they be able to? They've supposedly, at the conclusion of your punishment, supposedly you're rehabilitated.
It says it's an enormous public safety risk, said one division employee who works with several licensing boards and asked not to be named. It's contrary to our reason for being, to protect the public.
That's nice. I appreciate you. But that's not America.
But is it even actually an enormous public safety risk? I don't know that we have any evidence to support that that's even a true statement.
It's one of those things where people say if it saves one, to me it's irrelevant. If it saves one, if it saves 44,000, it doesn't matter. Because the person has done and paid their debt to society. We don't do preventative detention. We don't do guesswork here in this country. We shouldn't do guesswork. They paid their debt. They should be able to drive a taxi. They should be able to make plumbing service calls. They should be able to be an accountant. They should be able to do those things that they do. Now, if you have an accounting board, for example, you may be permanently barred from the profession because they may pull your license, like an attorney can be disbarred. And although you've paid your debt to society, the attorney may be permanently disbarred because of the egregiousness of the violation. But in terms of just a person having a license and being a level 3 sex offender, if they pay their debt, and I focus on that so much because that's where the courts are coming down on the dividing line. If you see that Packingham, you see that over and over again, these restrictions are particularly problematic for people who have paid their debt to society.
And I would be willing to accept if someone has some sort of money kind of conviction that you wouldn't then necessarily want them to be an accountant. I can see a parallel there. And maybe there's not like a permanent bar on it. But then when you go to try and get that job, you don't want Bernie Madoff managing your finances. That would be a bad idea.
Probably would be. But again, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who are doing something that has no relationship.
Correct. Totally with you.
If you're making plumbing service calls, unless you pretended you were a plumber when you committed your sex offense and knocked at the door with a uniform and snatched a child, there's no correlation.
And yeah, that's all I got, man. I can't even push back on this one anymore. I'm just if you're done, you're done. And unless that employer wants to do it, aren't we always talking about that you don't want the big bad government determining who can and who can't do a particular thing?
I thought that's what this whole country was all about. I thought that was precisely what we were all about. I thought that we were the land of the free. I've heard that all my life. I hear that the land of the free. I thought if a person wanted to have a 300-unit apartment complex and they wanted to rent to 20 people on the registry, I didn't think that the big old bad government in a land of freedom would interfere with that relationship. But apparently they do.
I think that is definitely something that
I thought that we claimed you could be all you could be in this country. I thought we professed that. So if you could go out and get yourself a plumbing truck and equip it and make service calls and make a living, wouldn't that be what we would want? Maybe.
By the way, be all you can be is just from the Army. That's not a countrywide mantra.
Yeah, well, I haven't heard that in years and years, but that's what we say in this country. You can grow up to be president. You can be anything. This is the land where you can, there's your opportunity is just limitless. Really?
Of course.
Well, it doesn't seem like it's so limitless if you read this kind of stuff.
No, definitely. All right. So let's move over to law.com, the legal intelligencer, which I can't even believe is a word. Three states extend statute of limitations on sexual assault, abuse, harassment. I think that's the British way to pronounce it. Harassment. Harassment claims. Three populous and trend-setting states, Jersey, New York, and California, recently enacted new laws that provide a vast window of opportunity for complaints to bring otherwise time-barred claims of sexual assault. God, that's a long sentence. Abuse and harassment. So there you go. More. These are definitely blue states are leading the charge of reducing the or extending the statute of limitations to probably something close to forever. I can't read the rest of the article.
I don't have the full article. I did read it earlier, but this is a trend. It's not going to be shake out red or blue. The blue states are going to be just as bad because it's where the people are right now. And you have to recognize that when the people are clamoring for something to be done because of these high profile cases, the lawmakers are under enormous pressure. It's very political, almost suicidal to push back on this stuff if you're in the assembly. Because you hate women, you hate victims, you're insensitive, you're in denial. I mean, they go on and on, and then they vilify you. And so this is one of those things where you're going to see this cascading effect continue until we have coast-to-coast eradication of the statute of limitations or being so worthless that it may as well be eradicated. But that's where we're headed.
Is there anybody besides the Larrys of the world that are standing up against the statute of limitations increases?
Oh, yes. Yes. You have some
ACLU kind of places?
Places like that. And even they're not uniform because some ACLUs are so poor. They don't spend their precious resources being in the Capitol. Ours does. And they push back here. And the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association here, but that's not even uniform. You've got a very affluent state like Maryland, and their Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, last I checked, doesn't lift a finger. They don't even have a lobbyist, and we're 49th in per capita. We have a lobbyist, and they don't, because one lawyer told me in Maryland, he says that's actually kind of better for us if they make things tougher, because that makes our job more valuable.
Right. So who else, I mean, who could we even try and lean on, donate money to, whatever, to try and help push back?
But those are the ones that come to mind first would be like the Defense Lawyers Association, the ACLU, then the organizations that are tangentially related, like a mandatory minimum.
Right.
Those people, because when you do, I think in this article, it said in one state, they raised the age up to 55 that a person could bring the charges. Now think about
New York,
that.
If I recall. Yep.
55.
Yeah, so
really?
I don't want to ever discount that someone has something traumatic and terrible happen to them when they're 10. So you have 45 years to bring that to court where the people that could be evidence could be dead. The building where the evidence could be is certainly long been cleaned and gone over, possibly demolished. I don't see how I'm totally not trying to take away that the person had something happen, but how is the person that's being accused have to have, how are they supposed to have any level of proper defense?
Well, but we don't care about that anymore. That's the whole point. That's not relevant to this discussion. It's all about the person who makes the allegation. We have forgotten that we were given a sacred trust in the creation of this system to protect those who are accused. And what was it about? Better than 100 go free and guilty than one innocent? Who said that?
I always forget.
We were entrusted with protecting people from being incarcerated by the power of the government, and we're failing in that trust because now it's more popular to be able to say, I hear you, I know this must have been traumatic, and what you happened was 50 years ago, and you would have been the governor had this not happened, and we've got to do something to make you whole. And that's where we are.
It's from William Blackstone. It says it's better that 10 guilty persons escape than that one innocent suffer. But that was published in the 1760s, so that was a, you want to talk about originalism.
Yeah, that would definitely be original, but I don't think we take that sacred trust very seriously anymore.
I'm inclined to agree with you. All right, then finally, before we deep dive, from GBH, which is, I believe, in Boston, demonizing defense lawyers threatens the quality of American justice. I had no time to read this. You sent this to me like an hour and a half ago. I have no idea what's going on here. Tell us what's up.
Wow. Now, that's, don't be exaggerating. It was more hours than that. What people are missing in our adversarial system, and that's what this attempts to deal with, is that when you demonize an institution, and we get a little bit of that out of the White House, quite a bit actually, when you demonize the profession of criminal defense lawyers simply because they do a job for a person who has had the power of the state or the federal government aimed at them, that you're not condoning what they are accused of doing. You're doing what an adversarial system does, which is you're holding the accuser to the burden of proof of beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is pointing out that the more we demonize people like Jeffrey Epstein deserved representation. Jeffrey Epstein, I've said it repeatedly, these police officers that get accused of some of these egregious crimes that we look at and say, gee, I can't believe he did that. They still are entitled to be represented because the state has a vast apparatus that they're turning on them. And the individual has nothing but one person to speak for them and to make sure that the state is following the rules of how this process is supposed to unfold. And when we demonize the people who do that job, it threatens their safety because there are people out there who want to hurt lawyers who represent, they're threatened with their livelihood. They're threatened. Well, didn't we talk about an attorney that got just somewhere in the ivory tower that they demonized so much that he was ousted and lost his tenure? I think that was quite a few episodes back. But the attorneys have a vital role to play, and demonizing them just undermines the system of justice. If no one can represent these people that's competent, then we have no system of justice, because then simply because of an accusation, then we just railroad them off to jail.
Definitely that. And, you know, we've had there are a bunch of movies out there in the public sector where you can go watch. I can't remember, I want to say it's called Fear, perhaps, but it has Richard Gere, I think. Anyway, he defended someone. He was a very high profile attorney, and I realize it's a movie, but anyway, so he defends someone who pro bono looks like just a kid with like a stutter. And after he gets him off, he goes down and talks to him before he gets released, and he totally tells him that it was a scam. But you know, the attorney had to deal with all the garbage and the crap of defending someone who was ultimately actually guilty. But firebombs at the house and being cussed out and tomatoed and all that stuff.
Well, it was the Harvard professor that got demonized, and he
oh yeah 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 yeah
Weinstein's defense. That's the one I was trying to think.
Yes, that's correct. I'm with you on that. Yes,
we talked about it on the podcast
probably 6 months ago.
Yeah, it looks like it was back in May, so it'd be about 6-7 months ago. But that's what I was trying to think of. But this is sad, because when this happens to you, when you have the state turning its vast resource and arsenal on you, then magically you're going to feel hopeless when no one will represent you because of the despicable nature of what you've been accused of doing. If that's the standard, then we just have to make the allegations ugly enough and sensationalize them enough, and then all the attorneys will run from you, and then you'll be hopeless in a system. And then a judge would have to order someone to represent you, because a good judge would not allow you to represent yourself if you're facing decades or life in prison, because the stakes are too high. You need representation. You don't understand this system.
And just to close out this particular segment, this is a commentary piece from an author named Harvey Silvergate. And Harvey Silvergate is a criminal defense and civil liberties trial appellate lawyer. So he is he's already on that side of the house, but this is just a commentary. This isn't something that they're putting together. It's like a factual, like this is just his point of view. But, you know, agreeing with obviously what the things that you're saying there.
So, well, I'm glad that someone does, because I sure get a lot of flack when I talk. they say, you just don't care about, you just have no ethics. And I said, well, actually, I think I do have ethics. My ethics are that we don't put people in a boxing ring that are not boxers. And that's what we're doing. And when someone goes in a serious criminal trial, you can do all right in a traffic court setting where the penalty is relatively minor. But when you're looking at decades in prison with complicated charges and all sorts of forensics evidence that you have no idea how to analyze, you have no idea how to navigate through the system of what would be admissible, how to do a proper framing up of your defense, you're hopelessly lost without an attorney. And you may be lost even with an attorney, but you're certainly lost without one.
Yeah, and you're also not going to be able to do it with an unbiased point of view. You're not going to be able to look at it with, just as clear as possible. I mean, if you're in it, we were just talking about the victims and being upset about them being a victim. Your opinion is certainly colored by being in it. You can't see the forest through the trees, as the expression goes. So having someone on the outside, the attorney, looking at it to some degree of impartial would help out a lot.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Just as a quick question, Charles throws one in here. He says, is a court-appointed lawyer a public defender, and who pays them?
Well, Charles, that's a good question, and it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. You have systems where, like in my state, all public defenders, if it's a crime against the state of New Mexico, and most charges are, there are such things as county and municipal ordinances, but where you're entitled to an attorney, largely depends on whether you're facing incarceration. And here, that's all provided by the state of New Mexico. In some jurisdictions, like in Georgia, it's county by county. So if you were in a affluent county like DeKalb or Fulton, which are in metropolitan Atlanta, you would probably have a lot better pay scale for the public defender apparatus in those counties than you probably would end up having if you were in a much poorer county like where former President Carter's from, down in Sumter County from Plains. And so it depends on the state and how they structure their public defender resources. But it's going to be either state or local resources that pay for them.
But ultimately, the taxpayers are paying for it.
Well, that is true, except in the federal public defender system, we don't pay the taxes that pays for our government. So I resent people saying the taxpayers pay for it, because we only pay about 70%. To 80% of our bills in this country, we put the rest on the credit card. So if you want to be literally and brutally honest, the taxpayer pays for a portion of your defense if you're charged with a federal crime. But they don't pay for your defense because we don't pay our bills in this country. We charge them.
All right. I'm pulling the soapbox out from underneath you. Okay. So step off that, please. So let's go into detail about this Doe versus Abbott decision. And I guess I can ask you a question right off the bat. It's 180 plus paragraphs. There's a crap ton of different classes of complaints. This is highly complicated, at least from my simple layperson mindset. Why is it so broad? Why is it so covering so many things?
Well, that is the great question, and I'm glad that you ask it, because we hear this all the time. Well, Larry, I don't understand. Why doesn't NARTHO file a class action complaint? Well, the reason why is because they're exceedingly complicated, and you have to get them certified by the court, and there are hoops to jump through. And courts do not like class actions because they devour a lot of resources. Because in this case, they were proposing seven separate classes. This was a challenge against the registry in Texas. And those who have heard about this challenge, the attorney named Terry Estes Hightower was criticized back in 2018 when she filed this complaint, because she had actually asked for money and signed up plaintiffs and charged fees. And she filed this very complicated proceeding, the complaint, and the proceeding overwhelmed the court. And I felt she was unjustly criticized at the time, and I said it. I thought about having her on a conference call. I never did, because the people in Texas were so critical of her. I said, well, gee, I'm going to irritate a lot of our supporters if we bring this person on. So I ended up not ever having her on. But I defended her, and I still defend her to a point. The point is, when you bring a very complicated case, the courts are going to find it. It makes it difficult for all the parties, not just the court, but you. If you have multiple defendants, they're all going to have their own attorneys, and you end up, if you bring all these agencies into a complaint and try to provide everything for everybody, you have, it's just a management nightmare. If you judge the fact that this case was canned, if you say that makes her incompetent, then Narsil's attorney, Paul Dubling, would be incompetent because he brought a similar challenge in North Carolina where that they had a judge where they had brought an exceedingly complicated complaint, and he voluntarily dismissed it. He didn't take it up on appeal. To Paul's credit, he was far too shrewd to let his case be flushed with all those claims. So they split off and they made smaller actions, and they're moving forward on an individual basis. But this complicated complaint probably led to its demise. But we can get into the Fifth Circuit's ruling a little bit. But it was an exceedingly complicated class action complaint, and it went nowhere. So when everybody says, "Why don't we file a class action?" Take a look at this. This will tell you why.
What is a class of complaint? I don't even understand what that means to begin with.
Well, a class action is where you hear this on the news all the time. You'll say the such and such a company settled a class action lawsuit because of the data breach, and everybody who was a victim of that, they all had similar claims had they been brought individually. And for the sake of judicial economy, it made better sense to certify that group that had almost identical complaints as a class. Well, she didn't want just one class. She didn't, what, this wasn't like that the breast implant blew up and you had one manufacturer and one defective product. She had seven classes she was trying to certify, and so you would have had seven subclasses, and that made it even more complicated. But a class action can be the proper way to go if you have almost identical complaints, and the law firm has the capacity to manage the lawsuit and to communicate with the plaintiffs, because in a class action you're representing everyone who's similarly situated, unless they opt out of the class and they ask to be opted out. Otherwise, if you were to win the class action, then everybody that was a member of that class within the zone, they would be entitled to whatever relief. And that's when you get these notices in the mail that you're a member of this class, you own this stock between this date and this date, and the company agreed that they put $75 million into a settlement fund, and all the investors who bought the stock during this period of time, they're entitled to a prorated amount of the settlement. Put your claim in now. Well, those are far simpler, and they do make a lot of money for the lawyers, by the way, because the lawyers are hoping that fewer claims come in, because that makes a bigger payoff for each individual, and they much rather send out larger checks than sending out checks for $12. So they're hoping that people don't go through the effort sitting in the claim for their prorated share of the settlement. But if what we're dealing with, folks, the class action is really not the most viable way to go, but we hear it all the time. File a class action. File a class action. Well, okay,
I
that's
think
what we said.
You should file a case in the Supreme Court that just shuts this whole thing down.
Yeah, but see, even that you can't do, because you can't file a case in the Supreme Court. It's not a court of original subject matter jurisdiction. You have to work your case through the lower courts, and you have to hope that you can convince the Supreme Court it would like to take up the issues that you have. And so you don't have any right of original subject matter jurisdiction to file something in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think there's been talk about something with the current administration that something could be filed. I think that's one place that one thing that originates there is presidential kinds of things.
Yeah, there's like disputes between the states. I think there was originally subject matter jurisdiction. There's some limited things where the original subject matter jurisdiction starts there, but it's very, very limited. You can't file our cause of action with the Supreme Court.
And then just to extend that, you can't file stuff there. And then where do you go after the Supreme Court rules? Who do you appeal to after SCOTUS?
There's nowhere else to go.
All right, so you just accept it, you tuck your tail in, and you go home?
And you wait decades for them to have a change of heart as the law evolves, and as they decide that they may have gotten it wrong, or in view of a better understanding that what they thought was the case is no longer the case. So if you believe in that rigid interpretation, you would never go back and review anything. But you either change the law, or you wait until the makeup of the courts change. Like for example, the abortion, this issue keeps coming back since 1973, because in Roe v. Wade, they said that there was a right to abortion, absolutely, in the first trimester. There are people who vehemently disagree with that, and they will continue to test what laws they can pass, how much restrictions they can put on abortion, because they just don't believe that they should happen. And those cases continue to work their way up through the court system. And eventually, we'll get a test of Roe versus Wade that'll be accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll see if they still believe that you have an absolute right under the Constitution to have an abortion. Justice Scalia said you absolutely did not. So if you had five of his mindset, there would be no right to an abortion. You would have to create it through your state legislature, because there, as far as he was concerned, there is no U.S. constitutional right.
And if you had nine RBGs, then you would always have it too.
Well, if you had nine of them, if you had five, you'd be all right. But you know, it's a dubious right, I'll have to say. I mean, the way they created that out of the right to privacy, that's stretching to come up with a right to. But on the other hand, they had a rational. When they carved out that, they said if you couldn't control your body, what could you control?
That is an interesting point of view. I won't argue.
So well, let's look up further in this. The opinion is not that long. And I've put it in here with highlights. The complaint is also available for those who want to read it, but it's not the final complaint. I understand she filed an amended complaint, and I was too cheap and lazy to go pull the amended complaint. But the original complaint is the one that I have here. But the Fifth Circuit decision is actually quite short. It's 10 pages, and there's highlights all throughout it. And the big thing that people need to take from this is that just because the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals found that Michigan's registry had evolved through the 2006 and 2011 amendments, that it inflicted punishment, that somehow or another that makes all state registries vulnerable. It does not. Vermont's registry isn't the least bit vulnerable, in my opinion, because you mail a form in. You can live where you want to. You can work where you want to. Your address is not on the internet. I probably got thousands of people heading to Vermont right now after saying that. But you couldn't argue that imposes any disability restraint if you can live where you want to. You can work where you want to. You don't have to go see the police. You mail the form into them. They don't disclose your address. They do say they do put your a certain number of offenders on the website, but they don't put your home address. They put your city and your state.
Right, they get you sort of like a general geography, not the actual pinpoint.
That is correct. So now, if you live in a small town, if there's 114 people in your town, they're probably going to know who you are, even though the address is not there. But if you live in Burlington, they probably won't know where you are. If you live in Bennington, they probably won't know where you are. So if you live in Montpelier, which is a little bit smaller, they might know where you are, because that's actually the smallest capital we have. But as you go through this, if you go through this decision, you'll see that apparently Ms. Estes Hightower may have made some strategic blunders. One was the complexity of the lawsuit, and the next one is that she did not distinguish that she was doing an as-applied challenge versus a facial challenge, and that's in footnote 3 on page 3. She didn't distinguish that she was doing an as-applied challenge. A facial challenge means that there's no set of circumstances by which something could be done. And that's the only way a court can declare something facially unconstitutional, is if there's no scenario that you could create where that could lawfully be permissible. Example, can't leave your house between 9 and 12 on Sunday morning. That would be facially unconstitutional, because there'd be no set of circumstances by which we could have that as a law. That would interfere with your right to religion and worship, so that would be on its face unconstitutional. So therefore, no set of circumstances I can conceive of. Possibly martial law if we were in a state of emergency, but otherwise, having a curfew of that nature would not stand, because it would interfere with constitutional rights. So that would be a facial unconstitutional. But she apparently made that mistake, the complexity mistake of making the thing, tried to include everybody in the lawsuit and every conceivable issue she had. And then she didn't thoroughly analyze what the court had said in Michigan in the Doe's case. They did not thoroughly analyze it. And I get grief for this all the time. I tell people in my state, Larry, why don't you go ahead and why don't you people launch your lawsuit? You've been talking about it for years and you have no credibility, and all we hear is mumbo jumbo and talk out of you people. And I say, yes, that's all you hear is mumbo jumbo, because we're trying to save your money until the case law shapes up, and we're waiting on a case out of the Tenth Circuit that hasn't been decided yet, that's on appeal, and we're waiting for that. But our registry has not evolved to the level that Michigan's had. You can live where you want to. You can work where you want to. You can be where you want to. The registry makes no impairments on where you can go, where you can live, who you can be with. None of those things are imposed by the registry here. So we don't have any fees, so you can't allege that it's punitive because they're not charging you $600 a year like they're doing in Lake Charles, Louisiana last time I heard. So you end up with people not appreciating that their registry is not the same as Michigan's. And if you read in the decision here, the court in the footnotes make it clear that Ms. Estes Hightower relied heavily on the Snyder case. And it says, especially important in footnote 12 to the holding of Snyder was that the provision that prohibited registered sex offenders from living, working, or loitering within 1,000 feet of a school zone, that does not exist in Texas. The Texas law only has one minor restriction for people living on campus, and so she jumped the gun, in my view, by assuming that the Sixth Circuit was going to give her what she needed. The Sixth Circuit didn't give her what she needed because her situation did not equate in Texas to what was going on in Michigan, and the reporting requirements in Texas are far more lenient than are in Michigan in terms of how quickly you had to do. You have more frequent reporting, and you have to report things in person that apparently allowed to be reported by other means in Texas. In some states, you have to go in and report everything in person. I think Nebraska is an example that any change has to be reported in person, and that's not the way it should be, but that's the way it is be in Nebraska.
Is be, huh?
That's the way it is be. I haven't said that for a while.
What else is important? Is there anything else that you see as like a glaring strategic error?
The strategic error I see was the complexity and then not thoroughly analyzing Michigan. You need there's nothing wrong with her asking for money for take. What you do need to tell people though, and you will get spitballs thrown at you for doing this. You need to tell people, look, our situation in Texas here is not what they have in Michigan. So we are in a different scenario here. We don't have those restrictions, and I'm afraid that if we go forward with this. Although I want to win this as bad as you do, because I don't think any of this stuff is constitutional, I'm afraid we're going to set bad precedent because the Fifth Circuit is not likely to come down the same way the Sixth Circuit did. And then we're going to have a decision that's going to be guiding for years to come. And it's going to set us back. So I would really like to, as much as I hate to tell you this, I would really like for us to wait and let's see if the lawmakers are constantly tinkering. Let's see if they add any additional restrictions. But I think we might be premature now. That's what I would tell people. And they don't like it when you tell them that. They say that you're just doom and gloom and that you're timid and there's something wrong with you. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. You have to have very thick skin when you tell people stuff like this because they hate you for it.
Well, okay. So are we ready to move on or is there anything else?
I think we're ready to move on. This is our last article.
Yes, that was. So then we are going to hit a voicemail message from our good friend Jeff, who is in Kentucky. I'm going to get it to play here in a second, too.
Hey, this is Jeff from Kentucky, Captain Crazy 254 on Twitter. I know Larry likes voicemail, so I thought I would ask this question in that form. First of all, the registry is terrible, and I hate every aspect of it. But I am going to play devil's advocate with this question, and I hope I don't give the state legislators who may be listening any ideas. Anyway, a lot of our victories against the registry come from ex post facto violations of the Constitution. In order to prevent that, why don't legislators pass laws saying that the registry is your sentence or punishment? Then they could add any law they want and apply them retroactively across the board and just say it's part of the sentence. So my question is, why don't legislators do that, and do you think they could get away with it if they did? I wish everyone who hears this a very Merry Christmas, and as always, FYP.
Well, there you go. I wanted to point out that Jeff has such a thick country accent that the voice translator thingamajiggers that turn the voice into text, they don't understand what he says either. So I get all kinds of crazy words when he sends me any sort of text to, or voice to text kind of things. Anyway, there you go, Jeff.
So he actually makes his question is actually quite rational. And the answer is, yes, they could. And in fact, I expect that they will do that as more and more successful challenges happen to the registry, which it won't mean that they can go back and make it a part of a punishment that's already been imposed. So a person who was convicted in 2003, they couldn't go back and say, well, we're going to add this to your sentence, because that, in fact, would be changing the sentence and the sentence has been final. But what they could do, and I think they will do, is they will say that part of punishment for a certain list of crimes is a period of time on the registry, which may be up into and including lifetime. So there would be nothing that would preclude them from doing that. And if it is a part of your punishment, then the constitutional analysis that you would be, the challenge you'd be able to assert would be, is it cruel and unusual, and is it excessive? And those type of claims in the environment we're in right now with very conservative judges just tend not to get a lot of traction. Because cruel and unusual punishment, if you can chop off a person's head or use the electric chair and you can extinguish a life, cruel and unusual punishment is a tough standard to meet. Because as Scalia said, it was what would have been considered cruel and unusual at the time. Now, I would make the argument using Scalia, if I was arguing to a court that was leaning in his direction, that the ideology was like him, I would argue that, well, yes, this would not have been something that had been thought of in colonial times. And of course, they would have thought this was cruel and unusual if we put people on a list and did this to them. But they did that in colonial times to some degree. They did have ugly lists that they put people on. They masqueraded people around and shamed people in those times. So I just don't know if that would be a viable. So in terms of the court saying that they can't do it, if they were to do that, and say you've got a lifetime of registration as a part of your punishment, I think they would probably be able to get away with it.
Thanks, Jeff, for planting that seed in their heads.
Well, I don't think he planted it. I think they've, as they've lost these battles, that's part of why they've extended the registration periods, as they say. In fact, I think in Ohio, prior to 2007, when they adopted their version of the AWA, I think that's exactly what did happen. I think the court did affix the period of registration as a part of the sentence. They determined what tier level you were, and that determined what registration obligation you had. I think in Ohio, prior to 2007, it was imposed by the court. And then when they went to the offense-based system, when they reclassified everybody, then it was based on the amount of time that went for your tier of offense. But there is precedent of it having been imposed by the court as a part of your punishment.
Very well. Then I guess we should thank our new Patreon supporter named David. And I believe you have you actually know who David is. And do you want to say anything about that?
I do know David, and he's a wonderful guy. He's doing a lot to try to help people that are returning from incarceration, trying to build employment opportunities. And he's been doing well in the community. And he's been a great fan of ours. And he recently was able to find the link and do the sign up. So thank you, David, and thank you everybody for 2019 and the generous support.
Absolutely, yeah. This will be the next episode will go out actually on New Year's Eve Day. It'll go out on the 31st. So we will have one more episode this year, but this is certainly our Christmas episode. So Merry Christmas to everybody. This will go out tomorrow, which will be Monday, the 23rd, I guess it is. And then everyone else will get it on Tuesday. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Best of success. And thank you. Thank you all to listeners. And thank you so much to the Patreon supporters who support us.
And it was a pleasure being here on Christmas Eve.
Eve. It's Eve,
yeah, three.
Eve cubed.
Yep.
Sure. Well, go to the website to find the links and everything. That's registrymatters.co. And you can find all the links in the show notes if you get there. Let's get out of here, Larry. I hope you have a great night and safe travels, and I'll see you next weekend.
And happy vacation, remainder of your vacation.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.